top Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming back after a big weekend. A lot going on. War still happening. Chairman of the Ways and Means, Jason Smith's going to be with us shortly. Chance of holding on to the House. What about a second reconciliation package? What did they learn at the summit last week? And what are his concerns for oil? Lawrence Jones is in studio, fresh off Fox and Friends weekend. And, of course, tomorrow we're going to hear about the terror attacks and the threats in our country after seeing four last week. Why is that? We have Tulsi Gabbard. We have John Radcliffe. We have FBI Director Kash Patel all front and center, and see if they play politics or they really try to get answers. And before we get to Lawrence, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
It's a glorious moment for the Cubans. The invincibility of the regime that has lived in the minds of Cubans for decades is crumbling.
That seems to be the case, according to the congresswoman and others. It's happening. After 65 years, Cuba's communist regime is falling as we speak. What can President Trump do to cushion that fall and transition the island to democracy?
Number two.
I think Democrats are going to come to their senses. It begs the question, are Democrats waiting for Americans to get hurt, to get killed, before they actually put your security before those who have come to this country unlawfully and illegally?
Yep, that's Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy. Get serious. Dems playing games, showing complete disregard for the American people by keeping DHS partially shut down, destroying air travel. TSA workers now leaving by the hundreds.
Number one.
80% of the oil that's coming out of the Gulf is heading to Asia. So it's absolutely correct for President Trump to call on the world to come help make sure their energy supplies are secure.
That is Ambassador Michael Waltz. Step up. President Trump tells allies and rivals, step up and open up the Strait of Hormuz as he takes out the oil island and all the military assets around it. We have the latest on the war and the rising energy costs. And right now, Lawrence, I think per barrel, it's about $103 per barrel. So it's going to stay high this week as the world watches.
It's going to be a little pain, but I think it's incumbent. Look, no one is asking the world to get involved with this war. I mean, we have that under control as far as the fight taking it to radical Islam is between the Israelis and the American military. We've done just fine. But if they have economic interests, just like we do, even though it's only a small percentage, about 25% of the oil that's coming out of the strait, then they need to help guard it and secure it. And I think it sends a message to the radical Islamists in Iran that the world is not going to take it.
Yeah, I want you to hear what Ambassador Walz said. Here's a little bit more from what he said yesterday, not only on CNN, but on Fox News. Cut 18.
80% of the oil that's coming out of the Gulf is heading to Asia. Actually, thanks to President Trump's energy dominance agenda, only 7, 8, 9% is coming to the United States. So it's absolutely correct for President Trump to call on the world to come help make sure their energy supplies are secure.
So will they?
I don't know. I mean, there's already some reports. We just had Caroline Leavitt on Fox and Friends that the president is going to delay his meeting with Xi. So the question is, do you hate America more than your own economic interests in China? Some deal is going to have to be done, or for the next 2 months, they won't be getting any oil.
So and Admiral Kevin Donegan, he used to run the Fifth Fleet, commander there. He was on this week with George Stephanopoulos, who never has George Stephanopoulos on. This is cut 26.
In the end, though, it's not going to be easy to escort convoys, but we practice it. And we don't practice it alone. Every year we do an exercise with 30-plus other nations in that same region. The last one is in February. Just to rehearse, not just with ourselves, but with international partners on how we would do escorting and how we would keep Strait open if Iran actually, you know, followed through on trying to either control it or close it.
And they think they're in control of it now.
So I would say this, and Brian, maybe you know the answer to this question. At least last week, it was the fact that they were still allowing the Chinese tankers to leave. Okay, we got to stop that then. If they're not going to play ball and make sure everybody else is safe, then that's a point of leverage for the president.
I think so. It's a global market, and if the Chinese aren't getting theirs, it'll affect the price. But we already allow the Russians to pull some of their 100 million barrels of oil out of the sea and allowing them to process it. So we sucked it up there. Why not suck it up and tell China, unless you come up with some type of answer, 45% of all your oil comes from that strait. Not us. We have 3% coming from that strait. We're really making great progress. The problem is you can't see it because we don't have anybody on the ground there. But we're making great progress. Here's what General Jack Keane says. And by the way, he's got the Israeli contacts as well as the American contacts. Cut three.
Well, we've been at this almost a couple of weeks now, and certainly we have made incredible progress here. We've stripped away pretty much almost 90% of the Iranian assets' ability to conduct offensive operation, and that's the obvious. Ballistic missiles, 90%. Drones, maritime capability. And also, we have just destroyed their manufacturing capability as well. And by that, I mean these are the companies, public and private, that would build the future ballistic missiles and build the future drones. The mission is progressing quite significantly, and our commanders on the U.S. as well as the Israeli side are very confident about their ability to end this in a number of weeks.
So this some interesting things at play right now. The president is battling two things. He's battling, you know, this military objective, but he's also battling some people that consistently are saying no new wars, no new wars, no new wars. And the president has been so surgical with this operation. I mean, the general just laid it out. We're ahead of schedule. We're ahead of schedule. Just if people can, just like with the tariffs, wait a little bit, see what happens. I'm not saying you can't have critique, but Brian, it seems like if you scroll on the other channels, if you look at the editorials, they're almost rooting that we lose this battle.
Remember, Hakeem Jeffries said this is going to end in failure. So the retaliations, this is what the Iran has done. They've hit 16 vessels. They also targeted the U.S. Embassy compound in Baghdad, but nobody was hurt. And you know what the president said? Just evacuate it. We don't need it. Just leave it empty for now, because the militias, Iraq can't control their own northern section of their country, and the militias are still running rampant there for now. Traffic through the Strait of Hormuz severely constrained, but they let the Indian tankers get through yesterday. Gas prices have risen 65 to 75 cents. Now, if that's the story in May, it's a problem. I don't think people are going to remember that much in March, and they say it's going to take a little while to get everything up rolling again. But just watch everything surge as soon as this ends. But I think the reports are pretty significant that MBS, Saudi Arabia, they were hit 61 times, blocked almost everything. They say to the president, finish the job. Yeah. They're not equivocating. They're not saying let's end this.
Yeah.
They're saying hit them harder.
Well, also, I think the part that's not discussed as well, I mean, you had that interview with the president over on Friday, and you saw the bearing of fruit of him not wanting to talk about something because, as you can see, not even 24 hours later, we attacked in that area. And we took that island, some of those sites out. I would predict there's only a matter of time before we take that island back and use that as a way to get the oil ourselves. So this is just a timing issue, Brian. I just think we got to be patient, give the president a time. But he's made it very clear. He's not going to allow the outside pressure to stop him from completing this military objective.
And put it this way, any clear-thinking person, will pull some of this from Bill Maher over the weekend, was with Governor Shapiro, Jewish. And he says, really? This is an illegal war? You don't see any benefit to taking on Iran? And he's like, no, I don't. Because he's knee-jerk, whatever to get to be president, I'm going to not be too pro-Israel. Are you crazy? So, again, Fetterman's the only one speaking honestly and clearly. I thought David Boies famously represented Al Gore in Bush v. Gore trial. He's been a Democrat his entire life. He just said, look, in the Wall Street Journal, if the president hadn't acted, his successor would have been left with an even more dangerous choice than his predecessors left with. Three or four years from now, the Iranian missiles now hitting Iran's neighbors could be hitting Berlin and London, perhaps even New York or Washington, perhaps with a nuclear device or at least a dirty bomb. Do you agree with Boies' assessment? What are your thoughts about that? He goes on to say, no sensible person wants a war. a president least of all. Wars destroy lives, waste treasure, and usually are unpopular. But the widespread hostility to this military action seems untethered to any serious discussion of the merits. What is the alternative? Obviously, few are prepared to say it's simply to permit religious madmen who swear death to America and back up their threats with terrorism to secure nuclear weapons and the capability to deliver them. The scope and the scale of Iran's response shows how much its military capabilities have progressed and how dangerous it would have been to permit them to increase forth. And he went on to say, you don't like Trump. That's the only reason you're not saying.
Well, it's spot on analysis. And I would say this, Brian. I understand why the focus, because it's obviously the most severe threat, has been on the nuclear weapons. But I got to tell you, the footage I'm seeing of the weapon depots where they had drones and other missiles, you really want the number one state sponsor of terror to have all these drones, one-way drones, and missiles aimed at our neighbors and our military bases as well? I say you got to get rid of all of those depots, all of them.
So I want to bring you to the foreign minister spoke on Face the Nation, of Iran's foreign minister spoke on Face the Nation, and he talked about nuclear material. Now, keep in mind, they never admitted to enriching past normal energy levels, never said that they were close to getting a nuclear bomb. We always accused them of that. They always denied that. We knew we were right. And yesterday, we found out for sure we were right. Listen to this. Cut 27.
This is not a secret, you know. The agency have said in his many reports the exact amount of our enriched, nuclear material.
Yes. So where is it now? Who has custody of it?
So they are there under the rubbles. You know, our nuclear facilities were attacked.
It's just under the rubble.
And everything is under the rubble. Of course, there is the possibility to retreat them.
We'll retrieve it.
Under the supervision of the agency. If one day we come to the conclusion to do that, it would be under the supervision of the agency. But for the time being, we have no program, we have no plan to recover them from under the rubble.
Under the rubble.
Can you believe him? Can you believe him? This is what happens when you're at war, is that you get frazzled, and when you've been beaten up, you start making stupid mistakes like this. So it was always there then, Brian.
Yeah.
I thought it didn't exist. No, it's under the rubble. Oh, is there any plan to do it? Well, there's no plan right now to use it, but at some point, well, you know, we may use it for nuclear weapons.
Yeah, they're building a new facility. they're building a new facility, and they're trying to rebuild the two that we blew up. Cut 29. Here's more.
Today, is Iran still willing to let go of that enriched uranium?
Well, that was one of the elements of a deal that we were negotiating with our American interlocutors. That element dealt with the question of Iran's 60% enriched material. And I offered, actually, that we are ready to dilute those enriched material or downblend them, as they say, into lower percentage. So that was a big offer, a big concession, in order to prove that Iran has never wanted nuclear weapons and would never want them.
Yeah. So
they're just flat out liars. Why do you have to negotiate something if you already weren't doing it?
Right.
You're saying that it was a part of the conversation, part of the negotiation with the American government. But before that, you say you weren't doing it. Something you will understand as you study radical Islamists, people that are on, I'm not talking about peaceful, loving Muslims, but Islamists, is that if you're an infidel, a non-believer, then they don't have to tell you the truth. They don't have to tell. This is deep rooted in their ideology, which is why many of us believe there is no conversion. Sure, the president can go to Saudi Arabia and other Muslim country, Arab countries, and get them to subscribe to economic prosperity. But when you're talking about cleric radical Islamists, they're never going to surrender. You have to destroy them.
All right, Leslie, before we go, on Cuba, it looks like they took over the Communist Party building, second floor, throwing out furniture, put the thing on fire. There's no oil or gas coming in. These people are running out of energy. When the president was asked about it, he goes, I understand people being upset. They just can't get violent. It's too late. What is your prediction here?
Oh, they're going to be done. And this is what the president was predicting maybe 2 months ago. when the Venezuela attack happened. And he said, they said, Mr. President, are you going to get involved with Cuba? And he said, I don't think I'm going to have to. Now, there are some reports that Marco Rubio has been talking with the Sun. We'll see where those conversations are going. But I love how, you know, the narrative in the media is that the world is on fire. The world is not on fire. Liberty is happening. Whether you're talking about Mexico, Cuba, Venezuela, what's happening in Iran, people want to be free. And they don't want dictatorships, and they don't want religious clerics,
or
and they don't
cartels.
Want socialists or cartels running their government.
So the year was 1999. The guy's name was businessman Donald Trump, talking about Cuba, cut 44.
You are going to win. And I'm going to be down here, and I'm going to watch you win. I don't know what capacity I'll be. I'll either be the greatest developer in the country or the greatest president that you've had in a long time. I'm not sure. I do know that if I could meet Castro right now, something I'd prefer not have to do, but if I could meet Castro right now, I'd have personally two words for him. Adios, amigo.
1999.
You know, either he's just one of the luckiest individuals or he's not shooting from his hip. I think one of the, you know, the saddest characterizations of the president is that he's not well thought out, that he doesn't take in information. He's been thinking about a lot of these conflicts for a very long time, Brian.
Yeah, I walked into his back room the day after the State of the Union address, and all I saw was nonstop brackets and paper clips of different stories, long-form magazine stories on various topics put in order. Lawrence Jones, I will see you tomorrow. Let's not remember, we have a color wheel. Let's not wear the same thing.
Right, because you did that last week. You decided to wear the same color as me. So I decided to wear green. I said, he doesn't have a green suit.
Until tomorrow. Right. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back, and in about 10 minutes, Congressman Jason Smith's going to be with us. You're going to want to hear this. There's going to be some action this week on Capitol Hill, because this, even though today is because of weather, they're not going to do much. But tomorrow, yeah, I told you they're going to have Tulsi Gabbard, John Radcliffe, and Kash Patel on Capitol Hill talking about the rise in terror attacks and what's happening next and what more can we do. Hopefully, they don't play politics. They actually ask good questions. Number two, I also think they're going to be putting the Save America Act up for a vote. Now, John Thune's in a tough spot. He does not have the majority to blow up the filibuster. I actually don't want him to, but Republicans don't want him to either. Majority, even though some have gone over to that school of thought, including John Cornyn. But he's going to put it up for a vote. And I think he'll get John Fetterman. I don't know. Would Rand Paul even vote for it? He just does the opposite of what everybody should do. So he's going to be at 53, 54 votes. He's going to be six short. Now, you could either go meet with Democrats and say, is there anything about this bill you agree with? Because the polls say 75% of Democrats want voter ID. And maybe they can do a deal. Or maybe they just will never do a deal with the Trump administration.
This episode is brought to you by Cologuard. Do you know what's really scary? Not screening for colon cancer when you turn 45. The Cologuard test is non-invasive, requires no special prep or time off work, and ships right to your door. In just 3 simple steps, Cologuard takes the scare out of colon cancer screening. If you're 45 or older and at average risk, ask your healthcare provider about the Cologuard test. Cologuard is available by prescription only. Learn more or request a prescription today at Cologuard.com/screen.
That makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Absolutely, there's going to need to be a supplemental, and I can't imagine anybody, Democrat or Republican, not supporting our American troops when they're deployed abroad, really taking out the biggest threat and the biggest killer of Americans over decades in the state sponsorship of Iran. So Absolutely, we should do that. Absolutely, we should support it. And let's not forget the fight at home. At the same time, we absolutely need to pass the funding for DHS.
And that is just maddening that it's not happening again. Chairman Jason Smith joins us, House Ways and Means Committee. Congressman, great to have you. Welcome back. First off, do you think we're going to need a supplemental to finance this war, like Dave McCormick thinks?
I would completely agree with Dave. There's no question that there will need to be a supplemental at some form. I do have concerns that some of my colleagues will not be so eager to support our men and women in uniform. I hope that they do the right thing.
Republicans?
Because
do you have Republicans?
No, I'm talking about Democrats okay. In regards to this. The only Republican might be the one that votes no on oxygen. So,
Tom Massey.
Other than that, yes, but I think the other 217 would be fine.
So, okay, what about funding the DHS? Can you answer me this? I know you funded ICE, but are they stopping ICE from being paid?
They're not able to stop ICE from being paid because in the big, beautiful bill, we in fact funded ICE for 4 years for implementing the president's border policies. And so it's so interesting that the Democrats are highlighting that they have shut down the Department of Homeland Security funding to try to prevent ICE from being funded when in fact ICE is funded for the next 4 years. Who's not being funded are those air traffic controllers, those TSA agents, the U.S. Coast Guard, the Secret Service. I mean, just look at this past weekend where you see people lined up at airports. You see numerous cancellations. This is all pain on the American individual because the Democrats' political games.
So I wanted you to hear Democrats blaming you. Cut 36, Ro Khanna.
We've been very clear. We want to fund the security of our homeland, but we do not want to provide new funding for an ICE agency that's going to continue to abuse the law, to kill American citizens, to have these mass raids. And what we have been saying is separate the funding necessary for the security of the country and have certain basic reforms of the ICE abuse that even Speaker Johnson acknowledges went too far.
So that's what they're holding up. They're not saying Greg Bivino is gone, Kristi Noem is gone, body cameras are in, roving patrols have stopped. They say, no, we want to have, we don't like ICE, and we want their masks off and judicial warrants out there. Is anyone negotiating?
It's very simple, Brian. They are fighting more for illegals than they are U.S. citizens. And you've seen that with this shutdown, with the last shutdown in October. That was for 43 days. It's so frustrating. If the Democrats don't like our immigration laws, they need to change them. We're just funding what currently exists, which is unacceptable. I will say that there is a lot of negotiation going on with Republicans and Democrats to get there. But unfortunately, Republicans have agreed to just about every possible request that's even unrelated to this, and they're still blocking it, which proves to me it's all for political maneuvering.
So right now we have oil about $103 a barrel, and you know, obviously one of the great things that Republicans have done, nobody better than Trump, is get the price of oil and gas down, because you guys are a pedal to the metal, whatever it takes, let's do it. And now we have gas and oil up 75 cents in a week. When they come up to you as a guy with the checkbook, what are you telling them?
You know, of course, President Trump has worked very hard to get gas prices down. Before the Iran conflict, we were at the lowest level in 5 years for gasoline. Unfortunately, like you said, it has gone up. The president's very concerned with that and trying to use every mechanism to bring that down because the cost of energy drastically affects our economy. It affects everyday Americans because you know, their percentage of their income to put gas in their tank is a much larger percentage than a billionaire's income in putting gas in his tank. So it does have a huge impact. But it'll work out. The president has a plan and he's executing it, and you'll see the prices go down.
I'm just amazed at what's happening in Washington State, what's happening in Chicago, what's going on in New York. There's this huge push for a billionaire's tax, an estate tax that basically takes all the wealth that you've earned. And it seems like blue states, instead of trying to moderate, are losing people, so they're trying to up taxes as if they're unrelated events. Have you noticed this?
Brian, these people have completely lost their mind. You're seeing, because of their tax policy ideas, they have some of their wealthiest constituents in the states of Washington. You saw that with the Starbucks CEO. It's the same way with in the states of California. You saw that with numerous tech billionaires like Mark Zuckerberg, who's moving to Florida. By those people moving to Florida, they're not going to have to pay the 10% state income tax in California. And that's going to really, really put a hamper to the state budgets for California, Washington State. And why will those budgets be reduced? Simply because of their ridiculous policies that they're proposing.
I want you to hear Republican Lonnie Chen on Meet the Press yesterday going into the midterms, Cup 47.
I do think it's crucial for the president to endorse Senator Cornyn if Republicans want to hang on to that seat in Texas. I think the reality, though, is that the affordability issues, that is going to be where Republicans are unified. That is where the energy is going to come from. And remember, in an election year, what we're really concerned about is energy, the energy of the respective bases. And right now, the danger for Republicans is that the Democratic base is more energized and more unified. So Republicans have to figure out a way, a set of issues is probably, you know, I think the Save America Act does energize Republicans. I think it does energize the base, but affordability energizes everybody.
So what are your thoughts? I'm sure you heard this coming out of your caucus and your brainstorming sessions.
Well, I totally believe that this election is about affordability, which every election is about affordability, to be honest, Brian, because people care about their pocketbook. They care about their disposable income. And so that's front and center. But, you know, midterm elections are base elections, and it's about voter intensity. I can tell you that Democrats are going to run to the polling places with their hair on fire because they have so much hate for President Trump's policies. Republicans need to look at all the great things that has happened under Republican control in the House, the Senate, and the White House. If you look at the big, beautiful bill, just the conservative wins that's within that bill, for the first time in the history of America, you defunded Planned Parenthood. For the first time in the history of America, you provided a federal school choice program. For the first time since 1925, you eliminated a tax on the Second Amendment, so more than 100 years. So there's a lot of conservative things that the base should be very happy about that Republicans have delivered on that no one's talking about.
So right now, a new poll shows that the Democratic Party, 52% of voters view the Democratic Party negatively. Only 30% view it positively. And we also know the Democratic National Committee is carrying a $17 million debt. Thanks, Kamala Harris. And they have about $15 million in hand. You guys have plenty of money. I know for a Ways and Means guy, you never think you have plenty of money, but you guys have a ton of money. How do you use that to your advantage? And the fact is, Democrats are, their image is less popular than the Republicans.
You know, you're exactly right, Brian. You never have enough money. But what I will say is last year is the first year in 10 years that Republicans have outraised Democrats, which is a phenomenal statistic. But the way that I look at any campaigns, you have to beat your opponent every step of the way, whether it is you hit the most doors, you attend the most rallies, you push and raise the most money. You just have to look at everything. And if you win at every little step, you will ultimately be victorious in the end.
I guess so. And finally, when it comes to what you guys can do, there's a difference. And I think I quoted you. I saw a quote from you saying it's not going to happen. But there are Republicans who want another reconciliation package, a different scale of tax breaks. And you basically said, I don't see that happening. Am I right?
Yeah, that's right. You probably saw the quote where I said I would really love to pass a second reconciliation bill, but I'd also love to look like Brad Pitt. Neither's going to happen. And so what I meant by that is, you know, Republicans would love to pass it, but we have a smaller majority now than what we did when we passed the second reconciliation bill. And in the first reconciliation bill. And when we passed the first reconciliation bill, Brian, we could only lose two Republicans. And that's what we lost, was two Republicans. Now, with the smaller majority, we can't even lose two Republicans. We can only lose one, and you're guaranteed to always lose one member of our conference. And so if someone's sick, if anything, it just would be really, really difficult. And so that's why I'm saying there's a lot of bipartisan items that we can push through on healthcare and on tax and also on trade that's unifying. Put those wins on the president's desk.
I get on trade, that would absolutely be it. The USMCA, would you like to see it renegotiated? I think the president's kind of on the fence.
Absolutely. USMCA is extremely important. It was an overwhelming bipartisan feat in the prior Trump administration. Are there issues within USMCA? Absolutely. I have brought in the trade ministers, both from Mexico and Canada, to the House Ways and Means Committee, because we have jurisdiction over all trade, to ask a lot of pointed questions, because we have concerns where Mexico and Canada have not followed through completely on those agreements. And if people don't uphold an agreement, the value of the agreement is just worth the paper that it's written on. We need to make sure that whatever is agreed to or renegotiated in the USMCA is actually enforced by all parties.
The president said to me, I think the other two countries need it more than we do. Is that correct?
We are the largest economic power, without a doubt, but I think it's extremely important that we continue that strong bond with Mexico and Canada. Mexico is our largest trading partner in the world, so it's extremely important that we continue to grow that. But they need to treat us fairly.
Yeah.
For example, Canadians have been so hard on our dairy industry, and then you look at Mexico. Mexico, for the longest time, wouldn't even purchase U.S. coin because they said it poisoned their people. That's what the former president of Mexico said to me face to face in Mexico City.
Yeah, that's not good. Chairman Jason Smith, hopefully you'll be involved in that House Ways and Means Committee. Thanks so much, Congressman. Always great to talk to you.
Always great to be with you, Brian. Thank you, sir.
Listen, we come back. I'm going to tell you what happened with my president's interview on Friday. It was great. Thanks so much for your great response to it. But he yelled at me at one point during that interview. And then what happened later that day was quite enlightening. That made it all make sense. And I talked to him later that night on Friday night. And I'll tell you what I said and what he said when we come back.
From the Oval Office to the front lines, he talks to the people making history. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Join Fox in supporting our troops. From daily needs to global emergencies, help us be there for those who serve. Visit go.fox/Red Cross to donate to service to the armed forces today. Unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we are back. So on Friday, I hope you enjoyed the president's interview with us. Gave us a full hour, 45 minutes when you consider the breaks, but it was a full hour, and it was great. He was able to talk about everything, and it was at the end of the day Thursday. I was able to bring it back on Friday. I think it was used all weekend because he made so much news on so many different topics. But the one area in which he got mad at me was when I asked about Karg Island. What is Karg Island? It's where 90% of Iranian oil is processed. I said, would you take that island? Well, here's my question.
Are you thinking about taking Karg Island, where 90% of the Iranian oil goes through? And what do you think about, do you remember that interview and that school of thought?
Yeah, but Brian, I can't answer a question like that. You shouldn't be even asking it. It's one of so many different things. It's not high on the list, but it's one of so many different things. And okay, I can change my mind in seconds, but you know, for you to ask a question, who would answer a question like that? I mean, you're asking me a question, Karg Island, okay, everything. Who would ask a question like that? And what fool would answer it, okay? Let's say I was going to do it, or let's say I wasn't going to do it. What would I tell you? Oh, yes, Brian, I'm thinking about doing it. Let you know what time and when it'll take place. It's not, you know, it's sort of a foolish question. A little surprising for you because you're a smart man.
So, obviously testy, right?
We were all a little taken aback, but like that was a very, his reaction, we were just like, whoa, we didn't think it was that offensive a question. He wrote about it. Normally he'd be like, you're reading about me. Great point. However,
so yeah, I should refer to the fact that he wrote about it. He wrote about it in, what year was that? He wrote about it about 15 years ago. He said, you know, if Iran continues to screw around, I would just take that Karg Island. So I wanted to point out the fact that was eyeing Karg Island ahead of time, and are you thinking about doing today? Well, guess what happens about 5 hours later? He actually blows up Karg Island, leaves the oil infrastructure intact, and blows up all the military installations around it. And he says, look, if you actually don't open up the Strait of Hormuz, I'm going to take out all your oil production ability. Now, that would hurt the world oil markets. It would stop them from being able to rehab their economy should they flip governments. But this is what we'd have to do. And once you do it, or we take it and we just start taking all their oil and we pump it out and we take the revenue. Now, it would open us up to drone attacks and things of that nature. But if we have 5,000 Marines coming, they could secure this island. But a little bit later, he called me. And he said, so I was loading the planes when you asked the question. He goes, we were loading the planes. I could never answer that question. So, and he said, plus, I can't tell you about strategy anyway. But I said, wow, you got kind of angry. And he said, I don't think I was angry. So, you know, it's all right. I don't care if he gets angry. I mean, as long as he does the interviews, he gets angry at me before, it's fine. But he'll talk to me like that directly rather than just stop interacting or responding or providing time for interviews.
What we thought was he did get like a little testy about it, but it was more like than like off point. Like, why would you ask a nasty question? Like, that wasn't a nasty question. It was complete strategy. So we were all taken aback. But in retrospect, it makes complete sense as to why he had that reaction, because he couldn't reveal what we were going to do.
Yeah, he could have said, I haven't given any thought. But yeah, then that would be open him up for criticism, too. So why aren't you thinking about taking Karg Island? But now he's calling on other nations because we only get 3% of our oil from there. You guys get all of it. Why don't you open up the Strait of Hormuz? And this is a threat that's going on for 40 years. So they did it. And remember, the Houthis shut down the Red Sea. Went other ways. And you know who told us to double down, hit harder? MBS. Saudi Arabia. And guess who uses the Strait of Hormuz? Saudi Arabia. So they're directly affected, and they're telling Trump, finish the job.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, where there was a rally for Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Ayatollah. Isn't that great in New York City? You believe that? Hundreds have showed up to chant for those evil terrorists in New York City. Absolutely insane. I come to you now with a lot of intensity today because there's a lot going on. It's important for you to find out not what, you know, you don't have to be pro-American. Just don't be anti-American. Could you also understand, too, that Republicans and Democrats understood through 7 presidents that Iran was the problem in the entire region? Even when we went to Iraq, Iran was the problem. They're the terrorists, and they're the ones with the nuclear program. Remember, in the 80s, Iraq had one. And when we said, well, we're going to talk to Saddam about blowing it up, about taking it down, the Israelis just blew it up. It got Reagan angry, but they were right. They never reconstituted. These guys got it blown up with Operation Midnight Hammer and started reconstituting it and then building ballistic missiles. We had to do something. Michael Goodwin standing by to talk about it. We also have the president and CEO of the Jewish Institute for National Security of America on, Michael Makovsky. He's going to talk about the dangers that all Jews are feeling around the world and even in the U.S. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
It's a glorious moment for the Cubans. The invincibility of the regime that has lived in the minds of Cubans for decades is crumbling.
That is true, and this is unbelievable. It's happening. After 65 years, Cuba's communist regime is failing as we speak. What can President Trump do to cushion the fall and transition the island to democracy? Let's discuss it.
Number two.
I think Democrats are going to come to their senses. It begs the question, are Democrats waiting for Americans to get hurt, to get killed, before they actually put your security before those who have come to this country unlawfully and illegally?
Get serious. Dems playing games, showing complete disregard for Americans by keeping part of DHS shut, destroying air travel. TSA workers are quitting by the hundreds.
Number one.
80% of the oil that's coming out of the Gulf is heading to Asia. So it's absolutely correct for President Trump to call on the world to come help make sure their energy supplies are secure.
That is Michael Waltz, the ambassador to the UN. Step up. President Trump tells allies and rivals, step up and open up the Strait of Hormuz as he takes out all island military assets, oil island military assets called Karg Island. We have the latest on the war and the rising energy costs. So, President said, if you don't open up the Strait, I'm going to blow up the island. Something's going on because, guys, it's up. The market is now up 565 points. So they believe something's changing. We also saw the Indian tankers roll through. And then the president and foreign minister say the only people that can't go through the Strait of Hormuz is the U.S. Now, as much as that's not acceptable, we really don't need it. I mean, let these other countries go through, but maybe we hold up China to make sure that Iran's not making any money and make sure they're adhering to the massive sanctions on them. I think we got to grab that island. Grab it, and then we'll start taking the revenue. And when we, evidently, when the Iraqis bombed in the 80s, when the Iraqis bombed Iran, that's when they came to the table with a peace deal. So we'll see if that gets to change because they wanted to stay in power. Khomeini wanted to stay in power. Michael Goodwin joins us from the New York Post. Michael, welcome back.
Thank you, Brian.
Hey, what's the risk that President Trump is taking, and do you think it's worth it?
Well, look, I think that at this point, there's no turning back. The oil issue is on the table. As you point out, it was always the Iranian Trump card, no pun intended, but that is the one weapon they have, and to, you know, basically shut the strait so that only China gets the oil, only China gets Iranian oil, and nobody else can get anything else. I mean, it is a very powerful tool in their hands, and so I think the president is now considering multiple ways of dealing with it. As you say, calling on other leaders, other countries to join this, because they are going to be the victims also of these higher energy costs. So look, this could be a turning point in the war because it pushes everything forward. It pushes everything into that one spot. The other angle, Brian, I think is important, is the homegrown attacks in the U.S. Of course, last week we saw two on one day, one at Old Dominion in Virginia, and the other in Michigan at a synagogue. So that is another front in the war.
Yes, and what does that say, that they're able to pull off an attack in Austin 3 weeks ago, yeah, able to pull off attack in New York last weekend, able to do Old Dominion as well as Michigan? What does that tell you?
Yeah, there have been four so far in the basically first 2 weeks of the war. And I think it does show that there are these maybe self-radicalized, maybe even agents of Iran who are laying in wait to attack America. But as you said at the opening, you have rallies in support of the Ayatollah in New York City.
Do you believe this?
So this is insane, but it is something that the FBI and other Homeland Security has to be able to deal with.
I mean, I would never think that would ever happen after 9/11. I mean, we have a guy that's actually a member of Hezbollah. He's the one who shot up the Old Dominion and killed the National Guard member.
Yeah, that's right. And, of course, in Michigan.
Michigan, I should say.
Yeah, well, one of the things that really struck me about that was the way the media mostly laid on the pity that the guy who tried to blow up the synagogue had relatives killed in an Israeli strike in Lebanon. But it quickly became clear, even though the American media was about 3 days behind on the story, that his relatives who were killed were two brothers who were in Hezbollah.
Yes.
This was quickly put out by in the region by the IDF, but the American media stuck with a thing that so he were a victim rather than a perpetrator.
Yeah, it's a total joke. Thomas Friedman, a fellow columnist like you, definitely a Trump hater, does understand the region, and I think on every level understands the danger of Iran. Cut nine.
One of the strategies the Iranians have employed against America now for 40 years in various different conflicts is what I call the strategy of out crazy. We will out crazy you, okay? The reason the Israelis have probably done better than any other country against Iran is they will not be out crazy. And so that's always been an Iranian strategy. I did not expect them to attack their Arab Gulf neighbors, but you can understand why. They thought that's where they're most vulnerable. The American bases there are vulnerable, and they hope to create a lobby of Arab Gulf states to pressure the president to end the war. It will have long-term implications, though, for Iran's relations with those states. Remember, Iranians, a lot of them bank their money in those Gulf states. A lot of them treat them as a sort of a valve to go release a lot of their energy. So the long-term implications of that are going to be profound.
So it is going to be profound. And the Arab states, the Gulf states, have rallied around. And MBS evidently called up the president over the weekend and said, hit him harder.
Yeah. Look, I think President Trump doesn't need to be encouraged on that front. But Thomas Friedman, for once, is right that Iran has really lashed out at everybody and everything. And a lot of that, unfortunately, will probably come home, that we will see more of these attacks, which, you know, Brian, the FBI cannot be everywhere at once. And so it puts a lot of pressure on local police departments across America.
It is, and I hope the FBI steps it up. They're going to be speaking out tomorrow. There's going to be a hearing with Kash Patel, John Radcliffe, as well as Tulsi Gabbard. So we'll see what they have to say about it, and we'll see about the terror attacks here at home. You got to be vigilant, and I think the best thing is, the most encouraging thing is, almost in every circumstance, people have stepped up. Cops took down the Senegal guy with a shirt that said Property of Allah right down as soon as they saw him, no hesitation. And I noticed how courageous the security guard was, shooting through the windshield of the car that went through the hallway. That took great guts. And then when the National Guardsman was, sadly, a real American hero, was shot in the front of his classroom, the National Guardsman students jumped up and stabbed the guy to death. So at least we realize, no, we got to take things into our own hands.
Right. And, of course, the NYPD did an excellent job.
Oh, yeah.
At the Gracie Mansion, where those two young kids tried to throw these IEDs. So, look, the police everywhere now are on the front line. And I think in Michigan, at the synagogue attack, something like 600 police ultimately responded before this thing was quickly concluded, not knowing how far it was going to go with the explosives. So I think that's a good sign.
Yeah.
That the police forces everywhere are now alert. And as you say, in Austin, it was the local police who took down that shooter. So that's a good sign everywhere.
Michael Goodwin, also, before I let you go, Cuba, the president has predicted the Cuban regime is about to collapse. I saw over the weekend, Saturday, the protesters took over the Communist Party office building. There were riots in and around it. They were throwing the furniture out the second floor. And now the government, the president came out and says, I understand their frustration, but there's no immunity for violent acts. That is a capitulation. This is close to blowing. Here's the president, cut 41.
Cuba is a failed nation. Cuba also wants to make a deal. And and I think we will pretty soon, or either make a deal or do whatever we have to do. They've been waiting 50 years for what's happening with Cuba. So I think something will happen with Cuba pretty quickly.
I think so, too. And it looks like you could go. I think that this leader has a chance. You want to go live a life somewhere in Turkey or in Qatar or in Moscow? Or do you want to go to prison? Isn't that where it's going to end up? We're already compiling charges against them.
You know, Brian, oil is, of course, at the heart of many of those developments, because we have essentially put an embargo, because for many years Cuba was living off of Venezuelan oil, and we, of course, stopped that. It was a bartering system where Cuban medical students were sent to Venezuela and effectively kidnapped by their own government and conscripted to being traded for oil. But now that Venezuela is not providing any oil, that's what's really putting incredible pressure on the Cuban regime.
Yeah, and by the way, we're putting tremendous pressure today. We've identified the IRGC underground facility and blew it up. Hopefully thousands of the IRGC leaders are dead. Michael Goodwin, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
Back in a moment.
Don't go anywhere. Brian Kilmeade will be right back. Fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Security is extremely tight tonight. Just got to mention that, yeah. We're told there's concerns about attacks from both the opera and ballet communities. They're just mad you left out jazz.
That is true. Timothy Chalamet came out and said opera and ballet are barely holding on. I think he was just saying to Matthew McConaughey in the Actor and Actor series, I don't know if we have the soundbite, but he basically was saying, look, I'm not part of an industry that's just holding on. I'm part of an industry that is doing very well. And I was looking to get to the highest part, like Matthew McConaughey has before. I think he won an Oscar before. And now all of a sudden, everyone in ballet and opera are upset at Timothy Chalamet. Look, I don't even know the guy, but the fact that everyone's mad at him makes me want to like him, because what he did a fantastic job for 5 years doing this studying to be this ping pong player. I watched the movie. He was really good. He's unbelievable in it. He's best actor of this generation. I don't think there's any doubt about it. But some reason they didn't like that he was campaigning for an Oscar, so they didn't give him an Oscar. Is that what they're saying?
Well, they're making it out like what he said was one of the most controversial things said in American
Opera's
history.
Dying. No one likes opera.
It's ridiculous. Like when you watch,
jazz is the worst. People like jazz. I can't stand jazz.
You don't like jazz hands?
Don't like anything about jazz. I don't. To me, I appreciate that people appreciate it, but I can't appreciate it.
That's fair.
I don't know where it's going. I don't know what they're doing. In fact, I went to see a jazz band. They had their back turned away from the audience. I'm thinking to myself, why is their back to the audience? Are we in their way? Were they told it was going to be an empty room? And were they mad that we showed up?
I want to know more. Who brought you to a jazz band?
It was one of those.
You were pressured.
It was one of those. What do they call it during Prohibition?
Oh, like one of the, yeah, like the speakeasy.
Speakeasy.
Okay.
So it was speakeasy theme. So you open up a sliding glass door in an ice cream shop and you go downstairs and there it is. I'm like, okay. I'm like, what's with jazz? I wish I knew there was jazz. I can't believe it. And plus, it's one of those things where it's in the basement already with low ceilings. And when you play with the band and I'm there with 12 people, I'm like, I'll talk to you after. Can't say a word. All I pray is for the, I need these people to take a break so I could just get the house music up and I could talk to the people I came with.
There you go. Or you could dance to the house music as opposed to the jazz.
Mm. Yeah, I'm not much of a dancer. I don't know if you heard.
Yeah.
But I don't get it. It ain't more from the Oscars?
Honestly, I listened to a lot of it. That was the funniest joke made. But then if you're listening to other networks over the weekend, they're making it out like the big scandal. You know, Chalamet might not win now, blah, blah, blah. However, actually, voting for the Oscars stopped before those comments went public or went viral. So it was all nonsense and all this made
up. When people say he's in the lead, how do you even know?
They don't.
It's a secret ballot.
It is. All speculation.
Yeah. Well, Conan O'Brien, I guess you know where he stands politically, but he always said, as a late night host, you can't take a political position. Did you see the stat that 96% of all the jokes on late night television were anti-American and anti-Trump with the Iran. There's 4% were negative against Iran. This is the death of an Ayatollah that took our hostages. It killed 603 people. Yet when it's time to confront them, okay, you're not for it, but you put down our forces 1 week into a war every night on your opening monologue. That's what Brendan Carr was saying as FCC chair. I was like, what are you doing? You guys are in concert to run down this president, even when we're in a time of war. We're not talking about the Voting Act. We're not talking about the big, beautiful bill. We're talking about a war with a country that's been at war with us for 47 years that six other presidents had to deal with. And this one decides to address it, and everyone just jumps out against Trump.
That stat doesn't surprise me about late-night TV, but like you've always said, why is late-night TV focusing on Iran? Like, they can mention it here or there, but they're not political shows. Well, they're not supposed to be political shows, or they weren't.
Yeah, so did you hear about the new leader of Iran?
That he might be gay.
True. That was in the New York Post today. Evidently, that's one of the reasons they hate gay people in Iran. At least the government does. And the fact that he's gay is why, evidently, the Grand Ayatollah did not want him to take over, or at least was not naming him as a successor, because he was gay, and number two is not that bright. Pretty stupid. And he's not a religious guy. Evidently, he fought in the first Iran war, probably had no role because he was basically son of royalty. And then he's part of the brutal crackdown on protesters. So he takes over, but he's handpicked by the IRGC, where the president thinks might be dead.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. But they actually had a joke about this on SNL. They're like, good thing we replaced the Iran leader with just a younger version of the old one. But all of the other stuff they don't mention. They just make it sound like Trump put in someone
gay
more
moron. So you kill the Grand Ayatollah and replace him with his gay moron son, who his dad thought was stupid. All right, you listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. When we come back, we move on to another great guest, Michael Makovsky, President and CEO of the Jewish Institute for National Security.
Show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
And that politics is the only thing that will change the character of the regime. I think that's all we're going to see in the short run. But that politics could also create fissures within the regime, because this regime is not going to break from the bottom up. It's going to break from the top down. But it'll only happen when politics can happen. We already saw when Iran's president came out and basically apologized to the Arab Gulf states for bombing them. Right away, he got slapped down by the Revolutionary Guards. That tells you the kind of fissures that are there. But politics only happens the morning after the morning after.
Isn't that interesting? Politics happens the morning after the morning after. So when we stop bombing and stop fighting, for whatever reason, don't think that the regime, if the regime's still standing, don't think it's going to still stand. Is that what he's saying? And that's what you saw in the future, too. You weaken it to the point where the people can stand up, especially when the people are so oppressed. You're not talking about Democrats and Republicans. You're talking about total oppression, women treated like 10th class citizens, not even allowed to live any sort of decent life, cracked down on hung if they don't have the right headdress on. Here's more. Cut 10.
The way I look at this is basically there's in these Middle East wars, Kristen, there's the morning after and there's the morning after the morning after. Now, I think a lot of our strategy and what I've been advocating is kind of take the win now, the military defeat, what you've done. It set Iran back. And I would be offering them a ceasefire right now. Why? Okay. Because the morning after any ceasefire, the Iranians will come out and say, we defeated the big Satan and the little Satan. The morning after the morning after, millions of Iranians are going to be saying to the leadership, come here. That's my house there on the ground. That's my factory. That's my school. What the hell were you thinking? Okay, what are you going to do about that? That's when real politics will begin inside Iran. Politics will only happen inside Iran when we stop the bombing.
Maybe. I don't see that scenario. What did you do to my school? They'll just shoot you on the spot. We've had 15,000 combined strikes inside Iran. Iran's missile capacity is down 90%. Their drone capacity is down 95%. We're now bringing another battleship here, the USS Tripoli, with 2,200 Marines at least on board. And we took out 90 U.S. strikes on Karg Island. It's their oil island. It's their export hub. We could take it in a second. We might just do it. Somehow the markets are feeling more optimistic today. It's up almost 500 points. but the danger is still present. The terror alerts are on high for good reason. Michael Makovsky joins us now, president and CEO of the Jewish Institute for National Security of America. He's a leading Washington, D.C.-based educational organization. Michael, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
No problem. So, Michael, do you think this regime stands until the morning after it eventually falls? Do you think this conflict ends with them still there?
It's a great question. It's one of the most important questions, obviously, that the U.S. and Israel face. I could see it going a couple different ways. It's possible. I mean, we're reading about or we're learning about some cracks in the system where you have some troops not reporting. I think that's coming from Israel, these drones that are attacking these besieged militia checkpoints is leading, you know, which was a key way that the regime suppresses its people, seems to have having an impact. So it could help facilitate people coming. You know, it's really hard to game this kind of thing. Look, the people came out on the streets 6 months after the 12-day war, after Operation Hammer was done. So sometimes these things could happen right away, and sometimes it's a delayed fuse. It's kind of hard to know, but I do think this. I think a key moment will be when the U.S. and Israel say, "Okay, we've done what we came to do," and if the regime is still standing, then if the people come out, our forces will still be in place that might be able to help protect them. So we'll see. That might be a key moment to watch.
How would you rate the level of anti-Semitism in this country and around the world right now, 1 to 10?
Oh. Well, compared to what it was before October 7th, it's obviously over 10. It's terrible. And I give President Trump a lot of credit for fighting it at the university levels. But what we're seeing in these attacks, like this attack by this in Detroit, it's just awful. And I think, you know, what we need to see more of is people on across the political spectrum ostracize these people, these anti-Semites, everywhere. I like to see Kamala Harris attack, you know, Mamdani, for instance, as opposed to...
Oh, she endorses him.
Yeah, exactly. That's the problem. So when you endorse people like Mamdani, you're promoting anti-Semitism. So I think it's a real problem. I'd like to have seen people on the left criticize Mamdani's wife for liking all those horrendous, you know, tweets about October 7th. Yeah, there you go. So we don't see that. And unless we see that, I think we're going to have a problem in this country. And as you well know, under the Biden administration, we allowed in millions of people who we don't even know who they are. And you got to assume a lot of those people are still bad, and we haven't collected all those people yet and kicked them out. So I worry about those people as well.
So now we have a situation where Mamdani's going to meet with four Jewish leaders in New York City, I guess, to pretend as if he cares about their welfare. And I think some other prominent Jewish leaders are saying, "Don't, I'm not going to be part of a photo op." What have you heard?
Yeah, I hear the same. I mean, it's supposed to only go for 15 or 20 minutes. So what kind of, that sounds like an extended photo op to me. We all know fundamentally what his views are. He's anti-Israel. He seems to be fine with anti-Semitism, given who his wife is, given that they just defeated Khalil. The guy was the last week in Express. He had a bad year, and this is an anti-American, anti-Israel, anti-Semite guy. They had him at Gracie Mansion, so I think he's sending. He can't have it both ways, and I think the only way we're going to clean this out is really leaders on both sides condemning it.
Mahmoud Khalil is his name. Go ahead.
Mahmoud Khalil. No, thank you. That's right.
So the Michigan synagogue attack. The Israeli intelligence says the brother of the Michigan synagogue attacker was a Hezbollah commander, and they believe this guy was involved with Hezbollah too. Michael Makovsky, what's your takeaway from this?
I think we have a real problem here, obviously, and I worry, and he was a naturalized citizen, which raises questions about, you know, what sort of vetting, if anything, we're doing for a lot of these people. I worry about it very much. I think, unfortunately, all Jewish groups have to really be even more vigilant. You might think they are. I don't think all of them are vigilant enough. We have an anti-Semitism problem. There's no question about it that facilitates this kind of thing. And by the way, I commend the security forces and how they responded so quickly, the security people at the temple and also the police in the area. I thought they did a good job. But we just
all police forces have to be more vigilant. And again, I think this is a scourge that unfortunately we're going to be living with for a while.
So we're taking on Iran, the number one exporter of terror, and the ones who are doing everything to get a nuclear weapon. They even confirmed they had 400 plus kilograms of enriched uranium to 60%. But yet you have every Democrat outside John Fetterman against this operation, as if six other presidents didn't have to deal with it. Kimberly Strassel, The Wall Street Journal, tried to put it in perspective with me last night. Cut 15.
What's changed is the base is now anti-America, anti-Israel, reactionary to Trump, and these people don't seem to care about anything more than satisfying that base and cynically politicking all the time to get reelected, not about the country or about our people who are fighting this war.
They keep saying it's a war of choice. Do you look at it, Michael, as a war of choice?
Absolutely not. The Islamic Republic of Iran has been at war with the United States since its inception. 47 years ago, they were the big Satan, they keep saying. They've killed hundreds of American soldiers in Iraq. They were involved in that. Also, the Marines in Lebanon and in other places, they killed their own people. I mean, they killed over 30,000 of their own people in 2 days. And some numbers are even higher than that. This is a vile regime. It's unfortunate. The politics in this country, the Democrats feel the need. You would hope that they would see this as a moment to be responsible, like Fetterman is. Maybe the only way they'd be anti-Iran also is if Trump coddles the Iranians, and then they'll say, no, you got to be tough on them. But I think if this goes back, obviously, to the Obama years with the JCPOA, the nuclear deal. And we're seeing the fruits of that deal, unfortunately. It's great that Trump withdrew from it. But look, they got a lot of uranium. And I think it raises the question. And I give Trump, I think he's been very steadfast. I think there are two major issues left in this war is our troops and the Israelis continue to pound their conventional capabilities. I think there's two. One is the nuclear facilities and one is the regime. We can't leave. I think we can't have both of those in the country when we stop fighting, because this is the regime. If it survives, which we don't know, will be very, very desperate, I think, and eager to do something on the nuclear front. And therefore, we'll see. But I don't have the intelligence, obviously. But we can't allow, I think, that nuclear material at least to be accessible in any way, or we have to get it out of the country, unless the regime collapses, and that will give us a little more leeway.
Michael Makovsky with us, President CEO of the Jewish Institute for National Security. Michael, do you think there's a way to get in there and get it? I mean, if you listen to the foreign minister, he says it's buried. It's buried at these two facilities.
Yeah, he's talking about the Iranian foreign minister. So, right. So, as you know well, if he says that, I got to think the opposite. I don't know. I'll defer to Radcliffe at the CIA and the others. But I think if there's a way for us to, let's say, establish a security perimeter and bring forces there to extract it, we have to do it. If it's totally inaccessible, then that's fine. And we will say, well, there's no way the Iranians could get it. We're going to watch it like hawks. My concern is not just the next 3 years while Trump is president. While he's president, I'm not worried. I'm worried who's going to be president after him. So whatever is done has to outlive Trump. And we have to make sure, I think. So if the intelligence committee feels like there's no way the Iranians could get it for, let's say, many years beyond Trump's term, then I think then okay. But if not, then I think we've got to do something to get it out.
I know, but you guys, I think that after it's done, I mean, there's people within the Trump administration that aren't pro-Israel. The whole Democratic Party's not pro-Israel. I watched Governor Shapiro with Bill Maher over the weekend. He wouldn't see any merits in going after Iran. How do you, as a Jewish man who's pro-Israel, not see the benefits of taking down this brutal regime? It's insane. Why? Because it doesn't poll well, which shows you what type of president he'll be. But I believe you guys have to be prepared to even make your own weapons. Not you guys, but Israel has to be able to make their own weapons at this point.
Right. So that's been clear since after October 7th. They need to be more self-reliant on weapons. It'd be good for the United States. There's no way they could be 100% self-reliant. It's actually something my organization, JINSA, is looking into, because both our industrial bases of America's and Israel is inadequate for this moment, because we just can't produce enough weapons. And we, both countries, have to, I think, expand their industrial base to be more, not just self-reliant, but capable to meet these kind of moments.
There was this report over the weekend by Semaphore that Israel made it clear to the U.S. They're running out of interceptors.
Yeah, they've denied that. I don't know the reality on that. That's been denied. It's obviously a very sensitive subject for Israel. We'll say this. There have been a lot of sirens. I think more so this time, if you talk to anyone in Israel, they've been going to the shelters more than they were in the 12-day war last year. On the other hand, for whatever the reason, there hasn't been as much damage, actually. There's been far less damage in Israel from these attacks than there were in the 12-day war. So whatever the Israelis are doing, it seems to be working. But
just to back up your other worry, Ben Rhodes, who was a national security advisor or assistant to Obama, came out and said any Democrat who votes to support and fund this war should be primaried. I mean, that's where this guy is at. He supposedly, he fancies himself a foreign policy expert who helped do the JCPOA. What's your take on this?
It's terrible. I think it's terrible. I mean, no, it's a terrible thing that they draw the line like this. He's thinking like it's 2015, as you point out with the JCPOA. Any responsible politician in America has to be in favor of defanging the Iranian regime from its nuclear weapons. Now, you could maybe argue that there might be different ways to do that, but to me, I think Trump has done more with this war. Mm-hmm. He's actually helped correcting the mess created by the JCPOA. So it's unfortunate that's where the Democratic Party is. I mean, that's why they got an anti-Semitism problem, too.
Michael, what is Michael Bukowski, our guest. Michael, what is your take on the Gulf states? There's reports over the weekend that MBS told the president hit him harder. Do you think the Gulf states are still unified? Because they're not used to be under an attack like this.
No, I believe that. I met MBS a few years ago, and we talked about the nuclear issue. There's no question that the Saudis don't want the Iranian regime to have it. I believe that report. I would like to see, frankly, the Saudis, because they have a lot of weaponry. I'd like them to participate, actually, in this war a little bit. They have been attacked by the Iranians. I think it'd be in their
61 times.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. So I think it would be in their interest to show some military prowess here that they haven't done before. I think they're still overly hesitant in how they deal with Iran. But I think the important thing for them is they need to see that America is not going to give up. And I think they see that in Trump. So I believe that story. And it raises what you're saying. It raises whether the Iranians were smart in attacking all these other countries that weren't really involved in this war. They attacked the Emiratis more than anybody else, and they pushed them all in our camp. They have done a little, I think. It's a little sad. It's a little unfortunate that these Gulf countries really haven't done more militarily, even after they've been attacked. But it does illustrate, I think, how important Israel is an ally in this region, because they are a country of 10 million people. America is about, 335 million? And we are partners in this war. We have no ally in the world, let alone in the region, that is able to bring this kind of military capability to bear on such an important thing. So it does illustrate how important an ally they are.
Yeah, and that's why it's got to be successful. You put these two militaries together, there's nothing that should be able to stop them. Michael Makovsky, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Great talking to you.
All right. We'll be back in a moment.
Keeping you informed, engaged, and always a step ahead. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
It is a failed nation. Cuba also wants to make a deal, and I think we will pretty soon, or either make a deal or do whatever we have to do. They've been waiting 50 years for what's happening with Cuba, so I think something will happen with Cuba pretty quickly.
I think it's more than 50 years. 1960, it's 40, it's 70 years. I mean, it's 66 years. So it's almost 70 years Cuba's been suffering under this communist regime that doesn't work for anyone. I mean, they're driving Etzels, or they're using oxen and horses. It just shows you how backwards and how bad communism socialism is. Please just take an example anywhere you want in this world. Now, this Caribbean island has a shot at a degree of freedom. Why? The Secretary of State is evidently talking to their president and the Castro family about getting out. They understand they're done. They have no oil. They have no money. They have no. They have nothing to export except baseball. And they're done. Now, China and Russia, we had the, I guess one of their officials went over to Russia for help, and he says it's despicable what the U.S. is doing, but they didn't do anything about it. And what they're doing now through China, China's listening in on everything, 90 miles off our coast, that's going to be gone. Russia's going to be gone out our hemisphere as we get rid of this regime. It's not going to be bloody. You're going to come in there and have some Cuban Cubans come over and maybe keep the infrastructure in place and begin to get that place ready for elections. And it's got all the potential in the world. It was once a thriving place for not just the mob, but for Americans to vacation. It's got a lot of natural resources. We know that Hemingway loved it, and now we'll get a chance to go back wherever he is.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. We start here from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, and a lot to go over today. We have privileged to have Lydia Moynihan from the New York Post in studio. She took a break from her many appearances on CNN to join me here in New York City, right at 48th and 6th instead of way uptown. Bottom of the hour, we go to Jonathan Greenblatt, CEO and National Director of the ADL, and of course, the Anti-Defamation League, and we see what's happening with the rage with anti-Semitism here. So, Lydia, great to see you.
I'm so glad to be here with you. This is such a little oasis.
I know. Well, thank you. Are you one of the writers in the New York Post that comes into the building?
Yes, and much more so if I know that I get to be on your show. So, but we're back. We're back. We're back 5 days a week.
Well, I know, but I know how like, a lot of writers say, I don't need to be here. Not just the Post, but you do. You want to be in the building.
I like to be here, but I will say, it's hard to focus in an open office floor plan, which is what most newsrooms are.
And what are you in now? Open office, no dividers?
No divider. So it's kind of funny. Then as soon as you get here, you're seeking solace. You're trying to find a phone booth or somewhere where you could actually hear yourself think.
See, what's interesting is they built on this, not on this floor, on 20 and 21. They have rooms you just go in and talk. Do you have that?
Few and far between.
Okay. So
you might be getting a knock on your office. I'm going to ask you to take me there.
Yeah, take you for some privacy. So there's a few things going on. You're out there in the other networks battling for this war, which for the most part we have watched for 47 years around the problem, from our hostages to the killing of the Marines to they just did a study. The DNI, Joe Biden's DNI in his last year in office, said they killed 158 Americans or their affiliates have been killed or maimed or hurt by Iran. But suddenly no Democrat outside John Fetterman sees any benefit to taking on this terror regime.
Gosh, I mean, look, I think it's totally fair to ask questions, to be skeptical. Yeah. But what we're seeing isn't saying, okay, let's make sure that we have a great long-term strategy. It's truly a celebration almost of the other side. And I was on with a woman on Friday who said, oh, we're the bad guys in this war. And it's like you're talking about a regime that literally celebrates murder. They just brutally slayed 32,000 protesters because they could. You're talking about a regime that hangs people from cranes, where if a woman doesn't properly wear her hijab, she can be murdered and executed.
Yeah,
and she'll be raped before she is because the Ayatollah is afraid if she's a virgin, she'll go to heaven. So this is a horrible, horrible regime. In no universe are they the good guys. And I think it's been really alarming to see, again, ask questions about the war, be skeptical, but you shouldn't be celebrating an evil, murderous regime that is the largest funder of global terrorism.
So here's what General Jack Keane, he has Israeli contacts, U.S. contacts, knows what's going on in the war, cut four.
It'll take some time because they still have real capability there, and we're not going to finish until we take that capability away from them. Two, include what the Israelis are focusing on, Maria. And that is the organizations that really sustain the regime, the IRGC itself, the Law Enforcement Command, the Bajir militia, which represses the people. And they are attacking those militia groups that are in the streets at various checkpoints in various cities as we speak, and also the police infrastructure. So this is the mission plate that we have and completely focused on it. And we have some time to go, but the progress has been quite significant.
So people do not want to report that in a right. way, but Lydia, it's hard to see it. We don't get a lot of images. We see black and white video of things blowing up. We don't see the underground headquarters of the IRGC, which evidently we hit a couple of hours ago, that could have wiped out hundreds. We also wiped out everybody, like between 40 and 60 leaders in the first hours.
Yeah. I mean, you look at, to hear the reporting, you would think that the U.S. was losing. No, we're winning. I mean, Iran is, at the even if we stop now, I mean, Iran is clearly on its back foot. It's clearly incapacitated. You're looking at Hezbollah now basically being forced out of Lebanon. I mean, we're already seeing the sort of snake its head. It's still, obviously, they're still wanting to cause death and destruction, but they're much more incapacitated than they were a few weeks ago. And I think, again, I don't know in any universe where you can't be super proud of what our military has accomplished. I mean, we have the most sophisticated military in the world, and we've seen some pretty incredible, you know, autonomous drones, these new technologies deployed that are taking apart this regime. And I'm truly blown away by how impressive it is. And also the fact that, for the first time in 47 years, this regime is on its back foot.
So being that you're sparring with Democrats regularly over on CNN, do you think they really believe that Iran's not the problem, that we're the problem? Or do you think they just see political benefit from going on to Trump and keeping momentum going for midterms?
I'd like to say the latter, but I know, Brian, we were speaking about Mamdani before we went on air, and there is a strain in the Democratic Party of people who seemingly are aligned with people in the Iranian regime. We're talking about his wife, Rama, who liked all of these posts celebrating the October 7th attack that murdered Jews and where women were brutally raped. I mean, so there clearly is, if she's any indication, there are people in the party who don't think America's the good guy. I do think, obviously, I would say the vast majority of Democrats more are skeptical, and they do see this as an opportunity to go after Trump.
Mahmoud Khalil over for dinner, the Columbia graduate student who's created havoc over there. So we're trying to deport him right now. Sadly, he is not deported yet, hopefully will be. And the mayor has him over for dinner the day that we watch a police chief scale a fence and run down a would-be bomber. He couldn't come over for dinner, but this guy can.
Right. And I think that's, you know, we were also speaking about, it's too soon to see the policy implications of what Mamdani's doing, because it's been literally weeks.
You live here in the city.
I live here. But I think what we're seeing is the sort of creation of a permission structure that empowers people who do celebrate terrorism and do celebrate violence. And this weekend, there were protests supporting the Iranian regime, supporting terrorism, just blatantly marching through the streets of New York City. And that may have happened a year ago, but the fact that you have, again, Rama, who's celebrating terrorism, the first lady in Gracie Mansion, who's illustrating books that are calling Jews cockroaches, that empowers the worst of the people here. And that's something that I think we're going to see, and we are seeing, far sooner than the implications of the wealth tax and the rent control and all of that he wants to implement.
So Lydia Moynihan, our guest of the New York Post. Lydia, do you believe there's some type of alliance between the DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, and Democrats? So do you think that they, even though fundamentally you would think they disagree and they'd be a third party, but they, them and Islamic extremists, they seem to found a synergy?
Well, I think Democrats, like any political party, they want to win. And they're seeing whether it's manufactured the way that the algorithm, there's so many questions about whether or not these protests and the sort of fight for the DSA is organic or not. But they see that as a winning message, because they see young people empowered and excited about that. And they're going to latch onto it, even if, you know, except for John Fetterman, who's calling it out, even if maybe they don't completely agree or align with it, but they're excited to win, and they see this as a way to do just that.
So, and the thing is, the TikTok, I think, has a lot to do with it. It's totally underestimated in terms of impact, 150 million people on it. They say that we have the algorithm now. I would like to have experts tell me that. But the Washington Post ABC does a poll, and they looked at young people. They released a poll that found that 70% of 18 to 29-year-olds disapprove of Trump's handling of the presidency, compared to 29% who have approved. They support Trump, also notably less enthusiastic about voting in the midterms. 51% of 18 to 39-year-olds who voted for Trump stating that they're certain to vote this fall, compared with 77% that voted for Harris they are excited to vote this fall. So the president's got to address this.
He does. He does.
This is your bracket, by the way. This is your age bracket.
Well, I'm glad that the plastic surgery worked. Yes, I look good for my age. Yeah. No, I'm glad that you're raising alarm bells and highlighting this, because this is obviously a huge concern, and I do fear that the war could backfire, because a lot of younger people do not want to see any foreign entanglements, and I think we need to distinguish that this is not an endless war. This is taking out a regime that has been trying to murder our people for years and years. So I think that is one concern. But there is, if you look at, we have months and months until the election actually happens. And that is a lifetime in politics. So I think we need to start talking about these issues, raising the alarm bells, but I don't think it's a fait accompli that it goes one way or the other. And I'm glad you pointed out the algorithm, because I don't know how much of this is organic. You know, you look at the protests, how much of that is actually organic versus paid? You know, how much of this is people funding division in our own country?
Because you point out what happened in the Vietnam War.
Yeah, the Soviets
had
were the
proven
ones
to be behind a lot of it.
Who were funding it. And of course, when you think about the way that these protests have divided it, I mean, you only need like a couple thousand people to have a protest wherever, and then it creates an entire news cycle. It's covered by both networks. It becomes the big story. And it's kind of insane if you think about the impact that paying a few protesters, printing a few signs can have when it comes to dividing things. And even, you know, I think back to Minnesota or any of the DHS policies and the ICE policies we've seen, you're talking about a few thousand people who essentially changed that by protesting. And I don't believe that all of that was organic.
So the big story now is the price of gas and how it's related to diesel, and how it could lead to the increase in a price increase for everything from groceries on down. So Chuck Schumer sees an opportunity here. He does not believe the president thought about this ahead of time, yet it's been part of his national security analysis and the country's since the 80s. Cut 22.
How did Donald Trump not see this coming? How did his planners not see this coming? This is the one bit of leverage Iran has. Of course we knew they were going to use it. They've used it in the past. A college student with a basic understanding of geopolitics could tell you that Iran's greatest leverage is this narrow passage.
Well, by the way, Christopher Wright heard that, Secretary of Energy, and came back this way. Cut 23.
So he's either being, you know, ridiculously naive, or he's simply being disingenuous, which is more likely. Everyone knows that the issue with the Strait of Hormuz. Of course, meticulous planning went into what might happen with the Strait of Hormuz, how to deal with that. Our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Kane, is known for many things, but high on that list is an absolute meticulous planner of all of the scenarios that might unfold. So why Chuck Schumer says these things to try to undermine the credibility of the United States military 2 weeks into a conflict, just quite offensive to me as a patriotic American.
So Lydia, why would he do that?
The most sophisticated military in the world. They didn't see that one coming. That just totally came out of nowhere.
Why do you think Chuck Schumer's saying this?
I think this is the thing. There, it used to be that you can fight against Democrats, Republicans, but when it comes to foreign policy, there was a sense of unity. And now we see Democrats trying to use this war rather than say, okay, you know what? We're in this. We support America. We support that this is the greatest country in the world. Let's unite behind Trump. And again, you could ask questions, try and encourage him to end it. But now we're seeing they're using this as an opportunity to undermine Trump. And in so doing, of course, they're undermining the military. They're undermining our veterans. And this is a relatively new and alarming strategy.
So how about this? If we just let's talk Cuba, if we can. It looks like it's another domino about to fall. And it looks like it's going to be relatively peaceful. Riots over the weekend, the communist headquarters, throwing furniture, burning the whole place down. And it looks like the president and secretary of state are talking about an excursion so they don't end up in a jail cell. So this could be an enormous victory.
I think all of these things are interrelated. The fact that we were able to take Maduro out in Venezuela, it signals to the global stage that we are a powerful country who will support freedom. And you hear from the left, oh, well, why aren't we supporting Ukraine? Actually, in fighting Iran, we're actually supporting Ukraine. And the Ukrainians are thrilled to see this action. Zelensky's been very open about how excited he is that the U.S. is standing up to Iran, because of course Iran and Russia and China, they're all
supplying the one-way drones.
Exactly. And Ukraine is supplying drones for us in Iran. And I think there's a recognition that when you stand up to one regime, you're essentially standing up to all of the regimes and asserting American dominance. And the world is a safer place when American dominance and supremacy is asserted on a global stage.
So what do you think is going to happen?
In Cuba?
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to see a lot of American resources going there. I would not want to see any boots on the ground, but it seems like if this weekend is any indication, we might not need that. It seems like people are so eager for change there that may be able to happen without U.S. intervention.
A couple of things. We have that in the border piece.
Yeah.
They have action. Why don't we take it here? Number two, U.N. So what you got to do is get humanitarian aid in and get these leaders out. Put a temporary leader in front for a while. Yeah. Do the Delcy Rodriguez treatment of you pick up the garbage, you get the trains, keep the trains running, or the Etzels running, whatever they're using now. You make sure that they get some type of aid, but get these leaders out. Mm. And that's going to be pretty, pretty impressive when you think about everything, because as you know, Cuba's infiltrated into Central and South America.
Right.
They were all over. They were all over Venezuela. They were all over Brazil. They were all over all these other countries pushing communism.
Right.
And now all that's gone.
Right. It's a domino effect. I mean, it's striking to see the Iranian people, again, celebrating the fall of this regime in Iran, and to see so many people in both South America and the Middle East sort of embrace Westernization, embrace capitalism, embrace
Chile is the latest.
Exactly. All like the American project and the American, they're celebrating and embracing these values because they see the benefit. And at the same time, in New York City, the financial capital of the world, we're seeing people embrace the completely flawed and failed policies of Cuba.
Right. Lydia, what column are you working on? What's your theme? Do you know?
So writing a lot about Palantir right now. They've obviously been super effective in the military strategy, so I may be doing something on them this week.
Okay, that is the future of our defense industry.
Yeah.
Between that and Palmer Luckey and his group,
Yes. Fantastic. He's fantastic.
All right, Lydia, thanks so much for dropping by.
Thank you so much for having me.
Isn't it great? Thank you. Back in a moment.
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with the Brian Kilmeade Show. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Our regime has secret police. They have secret police. Our regime is oppressing women, taking away abortion rights, taking away women's rights in like 26 states. Some states where they're trying to have the death penalty for having an abortion. They also oppress women. They have the highest rate of women who are in STEM careers. We're kicking women out of the military, out of university. We're saying that DEI means women can't be hired for high positions in the sciences. We're marginally better. And we're doing it for Christianity. They're doing it for Islam, right?
Yeah.
So it's like we don't get told those things because it would take away the kind of American exceptionalism narrative.
What is she even talking about, Joy Reid? Why she doesn't have a network job? But too bad a lot of people feel exactly like her. You want to say that abortion is people that aren't free? So that's what she wants to hop on. By the way, that was right after Roe v. Wade, the hottest issue that Democrats were able to save their midterms on. And the president came out and said states should make their own choice, and kind of that was able to resonate, and other things took importance. But that's where a lot of people feel. I mean, the people feel like Joy Reid feels. Thankfully, those type of people aren't getting elected. My hope is they never do, because if they do, they're going to get into power and they're going to blow the whole thing up. And there's going to be a lot of people that are not going to tolerate it. And then we're going to have a huge problem here at home. All I know is we all should be rallying around a country, taking on the bigger terrorist regime in the world. And yet we're not. 15,000 strikes later, we're beginning to bring it down and take down the IRGC in real time. You'll see a lot of those reports coming. Keep it here. Brian Kilmeade Show.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
We are back. Welcome back, everybody. We're just following what's going on in the Iran war, also Israel, what's happening over there. Together, we have had 15,000 strikes on various different well-thought-out places within Iran, as well as the president on Friday taking out Karg Island, just the military portion. I sense that it's going to be the oil refineries, too, and all the oil apparatus there, the infrastructure. But right now, we have the market up 526 points. It's at 47,000 plus at this moment. I know it could change on a dime. Part of that has to do with the sense that the world's going to be coming around to understanding you no longer can be held hostage by the Strait of Hormuz. The threat is real. They're making it. They took place. It cratered the market last week. And now this week, it looks like the world is rallying to it and understanding, too. Yeah, the U.S. is handling it, but we only get a small portion of our oil from there. 45% of all Iran's oil, and all discounted, comes from the Strait of Hormuz. So go ahead, keep it close. That's why there's lines in China, in Japan. All these other places are starting to ration because of this. But this is not creating a problem. This, in my view, is addressing a problem. A huge problem in this country. And I'll tell you, it's good that the Arab states understand that they're now targeted. And I think they're beginning to understand, if they didn't know already, that Israel is not the problem. So their foreign minister hopped on Face the Nation yesterday and went ahead and said, tried to put on a brave face how well they're doing. But what they did is also reveal that when it comes to uranium, they have hundreds of kilograms of uranium. How about 400 plus kilograms? They really admitted publicly for the first time and where it was, and I believe why we got to go get it. And I think that that's the one thing that people should understand, that Trump's not making it up. Either of the weapons inspectors. Here's the foreign minister, cut 27.
This is not a secret, you know. The agency have said in his many reports the exact amount of our enriched nuclear material.
Yes, so where is it now? Who has custody of it?
They are there under the rebels. You know, our nuclear facilities were attacked, and everything is under the rebels. Of course, there is the possibility to retreat them, but under the supervision of the agency. If one day we come to the conclusion to do that, it would be under the supervision of the agency. But for the time being, we have no program, we have no plan to recover them from under the rebels.
And that's fundamentally one of the main reasons why action needed to be taken. Jonathan Greenblatt joins us now, CEO and National Director of the Anti-Semitism Defense League, and joins us now, the ADL. Jonathan, your reaction to the foreign minister admitting why the world should be in support of our dual action.
Well, Brian, first of all, it's good to see you, my friend, and great to be back on the show. I think you set it up very well at the top. I mean, the reality is that Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, is the largest state sponsor of terror in the world. And so the idea that they can terrorize global oil markets by choking the Strait of Hormuz, I mean, I'm glad that the president is dealing with it. I wish it had been dealt with sooner. Prior administrations had the opportunity to confront this threat as it was building, as it was intensifying. I'm glad we're finally dealing with it now, because this is a despotic regime that threatens its neighbors, as we are seeing. They are firing on our allies in Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Oman, Kuwait, and of course, Israel. This is a regime that has specialized in launching terror attacks against civilian institutions around the world. This is a regime that has professionalized and perfected the art of exporting anti-Semitism. That's their largest export, not oil, Brian. It's anti-Jewish hate. And so when we are dealing in the Jewish community with, for example, attacks in the last week in West Bloomfield, Michigan, in San Jose, California, shootings in Toronto at synagogues, bomb throwings at synagogues in Amsterdam and Rotterdam and Norway and so on and so forth. Look, the Iranian regime is creating an environment where all Jews feel vulnerable. So the foreign minister can opine and pretend like America and Israel attacked them, but they've been chanting death to America and death to Israel for 47 years, Brian, 47 years. There's more blood on their hands than any other regime in the world, American blood, Jewish blood. So, like, I am glad that we are finally dealing with this threat once for all. People, they can talk about how the president's conducting the war, whatever. This is a threat. Mm-hmm. And if they had had nuclear weapons, Brian, imagine the apocalypse that would have been upon us.
So, Jonathan, do you also think, I know you do, but I think about it. I also think about the next president beyond this one. And I'm worried about the Republican Party, but absolutely, if a Democrat wins, the Israel has to think to themselves, they're in this alone. Because there's not a Democrat outside John Fetterman who is standing up to say, man, I really value this alliance with Israel. It's so great to have a democracy in the Middle East with such a rich history. Who are responsible for? We're responsible for helping them become a country. I do you feel the same way?
Oh, my goodness, Brian, you are dead to rights correct. Like, yes, you better believe. I worry about whoever the next president will be. I mean, again, we had Republican and Democrats. Like, look, I opposed the JCPOA as a former Obama administration official. Why? Because it would not have dealt with the core threat at hand with the Islamic Republic of Iran. We see it now, right? We see it in the last, 6 to 8 weeks. They murdered 30 to 40,000 of their own people who simply wanted democracy. And they gunned them down in the streets. They murdered them in their hospitals where the wounded were getting treatment. They killed the nurses and doctors who were treating them. So I say this because if they would do this to their own people, what would they do to the Israeli people? What would they do to Americans if they had a chance?
Well, we saw October 7th. Right. We saw October 7th.
Exactly. We know. The ADL is actually suing the Islamic Republic of Iran right now on behalf of 200 plus Americans who are affected on October the 7th because the Islamic Republic of Iran funded, armed, and trained Hamas. Like, it didn't just happen. They laid the groundwork with their ideology, with money, with training, and with supplies. So I say all this to kind of get to your question. I got to tell you, I've spoken to Israelis. By the way, I've spoken to Saudis, Emiratis, Bahrainis, who told me, well, like, what's going on with America? Like, do we know the next president will be there for us? They remember President Obama's red line that he didn't enforce.
What about and Joe Biden calling Saudi Arabia a pariah nation?
Look, like, Saudi Arabia has been in our corner for ages. And again, we may not agree with every decision MBS makes. I get that. I don't agree with every decision any president makes or any leader makes. But Saudi Arabia has been a stalwart ally of America for a very long time. The Jewish democracy in Israel has been a stalwart ally of America for more than 75 years since the country was founded. And we need to support our allies when they face the Islamic Republic of Iran, which threatens us and threatens them every day.
So, Jonathan, the one Democrat that I thought if he could get the nomination would be pro-Israel, I'm having huge doubts about. Governor Shapiro sat down with Bill Maher, two Democrats talking, right? Let's listen.
Our chief negotiator said they were talking to Iran up until the war started. He said their opening salvo was at the negotiations. We're a couple of weeks away from having 11 bombs. They were bragging about it. If you were the president and you got that information, you'd still do nothing?
I never said.
I'm asking.
No, what I would do and what the president of the United States failed to do was be clear with the American people about what the hell we were doing here. Was the plan to go after the nuclear weapons, the weapons, by the way, he said were destroyed 7 years ago or 7 months ago, pardon me. Was the plan to go and do regime change, in which case, who the hell is going to take over? I don't think the son's any better than the father. Was the plan to go in there later, but then you got forced because Netanyahu forced your hand? Remember they said that?
So it's a matter of clarity.
Walked that back. I think if you don't have clarity on why you're going in, you have no way of knowing how the hell to get out.
What do you think about that? I mean, he named four great reasons to go in. And, Trump does things his own way, good for better for worse. He could have outlined it, but he also wanted the surprise of killing all 40 together at a meeting. So you can't really do that with an Oval Office address.
I think you're right. Look, the president has his own style. What I have clarity on is the fact that the Islamic Republic of Iran is a danger to America, a danger to our allies, and a danger to the world. They export anti-Americanism. By the way, they tried to kill the president of the United States, right, Brian? Like an assassination attempt in our country. They threatened other American officials, like with fatwas and death threats. They literally have tried, Masih Alidinejad, the amazing Iranian journalist, they tried to kill her three times. So this is a bloodthirsty regime with a bankrupt ideology that has massacred their own people. So I have clarity on the fact that it is a good thing that Khamenei is gone. It is a good thing that the president took out 30 to 40 of their leaders, like you said, Brian. And it is a good thing that we are bringing the fight to them.
And by the way, what everyone wants to say, they want to say, well, we exchanged an 86-year-old for a 58-year-old. Well, it turns out his dad thought he was a moron and gay. So did not want him to replace him. So I know Democrats think this is the best line ever. Do a little bit of research. He's not an Ayatollah. He's the supreme leader. Work with the IRGC to crack down and kill innocent people and rape and repress women. Congratulations, Democrats. That's your guy.
Yeah, look, it's a false choice. It's like, oh, this guy's even worse. Like, what are you kidding me? Look, they are all bad. And I'm someone who believes by the way, you know who I haven't even talked about? The people of Iran. The people of Iran who are applauding the president. Yep. The people of Iran who are thankful that Khamenei is gone. The people of Iran who want to be liberated. They want the yoke of radical Islam taken off their neck. They want to be freed. And they're an amazing people with a rich history who deserve better than this Islamic fascist theocracy.
So Jonathan Greenblatt's with us now. If you're watching the stream, you know him. But if you're just listening and driving, he's the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL. But you do have some good news. You did a study. You looked at 150 colleges and universities. Among the 32 criteria that fell into the three categories, Jewish life on campus, campus conduct, climate concerns, the number of colleges and universities receiving A's and B's on the report card more than doubled since 2024. So some good news and gains. Have you figured out why?
Yeah, I mean, I think there were three things that are affecting it. So number one, let's just acknowledge a lot of the radicals who were there 2 years ago, 50% of them are gone because the kids graduate. That made a difference. Number two, the administration. Both the administration and Congress, I need to give both credit. So the president, Department of Education under Linda McMahon, they brought down the hammer and it made these schools perform better. Again, you can argue, as some have, that maybe they went too far. I'm not going to make that argument. What I'll tell you is that holding the schools accountable to enforce their own policies and pulling the funding had an impact. And then thirdly, groups like mine, like ADL, in using like transparent processes to evaluate them and show them, here's what you need to do. And guess what? Many of them are doing better now because they're doing what we asked. All of this is happening because finally the schools are taking it seriously. They're suspending and expelling the people who were harassing their own kids, their own fellow students. Like, look, just last week we had Mahmoud Khalil, one of the ringleaders at Columbia, who was being feted at the governor's, at Gracie Mansion by the mayor of the city of New York. This was a man who led anti-Israel and anti-America protests right here.
I know.
And suddenly he's like some celebrity speaking at South by Southwest, being right from America. I mean, give me a break. I got to tell you, I'm glad that these campuses are better. And I know it's because of exogenous pressure. It's because of the work of the oversight in Congress and the pressure for the administration and some of the kids getting, you know, off those campuses. All these are reasons why we're finally seeing some real change.
All right, Jonathan, thanks so much. Always appreciate it. If people want to support the league, where do they go?
Look, it's funny you should ask. You can go to ADL.org, support the league. This week, we're holding the largest conference in the world on anti-Semitism. It's called Never Is Now. You can look at it online. Go to ADL.org to stream the conference. Mm-hmm. We're recognizing Robert Kraft from the Patriots. We've got some other amazing speakers, Richard Dixon from Gap. Check it out, ADL.org.
All right, Jonathan Greenblatt, thanks so much. We're back in a moment. You got it.
Keeping you informed, engaged, and always a step ahead. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
I think anybody who's got to face an election this year is going to be worried about this issue. Look, this war represents, in my view, the single biggest challenge to the president's electoral coalition from 2024. Because what you have is you have a lot of independents right now who are very concerned about both where the war is headed, but also these affordability issues. And the longer this goes on without a definitive sense of what the end game looks like.
And that is a guy I really like, Lonnie Chen. I had a chance to meet him when I went to the Hoover Institute. Really smart guy. He ran for office, a Republican, and he's doing analysis. And that's what you need. You don't need advocates. You need analysis at this point. And then, and we're so far out that he's not worried about votes flipping. He's just looking. He's trying to make things affordable, and this war starts. But Lonnie Chen also works for Condoleezza Rice with. And if you listen to some of her remarks, which she said with Bret Baier and which she said in her own tapes, she knows how valuable it is to take down Iran. She knows it from the beginning. And she knew it as Secretary of State, National Security Advisor with George W. Bush. She knew how many people were killed. She probably knew some of them because Iran got in and pushed for this insurgency that killed so many Americans. 604 overall and almost 2,000 wounded, maybe were never the same when they came back. So when you have Donald Trump take them on before they get a nuclear weapon, you're going to have a hard time with political scientists or any State Department official who isn't blinded somehow by politics to say, way to go. And then you ask, what's the strategy? Is it just drop a bomb? No. It's a very detailed strategy, along with the second best military in the world, pound for pound, Israel, who have more intelligence than any, even Iranians do about their own country, who, by the way, when it's all said and done, you're going to find out, help kill hundreds of IRGC and besiege who are the thugs that roam the streets. And about an hour ago, it was reported that we just blew up an underground tunnel where the IRGC was meeting. How many we were killed there? So people like to run with, well, the Ayatollah, the new Ayatollah is younger than the other supreme leader. And wow, the Strait of Hormuz has cost oil to double per barrel. Okay. And then you ask yourself, for how long? And at what cost? And how many years until they had an intercontinental ballistic missile? Well, look at North Korea. They were shooting them out over the weekend. Remember, they got barely off our shores. And now they got nukes, multiple nukes. So now we're supposed to just turn and look the other way? So I just think if you want to say, you know, why now or things of that nature, just take in some facts and don't just do what these senators are doing, like Cory Booker coming out, this president's doing an illegal war, or the senator from Maryland, or Adam Schiff, who the minute I hear his voice, I literally turn the channel or shut the TV off, because he's such a liar and he's so full of it. And he used to talk about how the need to confront Iran was so necessary. And now he says, I get a chance to be successful and get the majority in the midterms. The president gets this done in March, early April. I'm telling you, oil's going to drop down by May. And things are going to start rolling again. Only there's going to be one thing missing from the Middle East. And that's a menace. And you're going to see the Abraham Accords continue to grow. You just watch. Brian Kilmeade.